Tremendous challenges and opportunities exist right now for our nation's water infrastructure. In this podcast, the industry's top leaders and innovative minds share their knowledge and insights for ensuring our water systems are operating safely and efficiently. These discussions are designed to motivate and create vibrant 21st century water systems and the innovative workforce required to lead and operate them. This is 21st Century Water with your host, AquaSight founder and CEO, Mahesh Lunani.
So I'm with Pam Alardo. She's a deputy commissioner at New York City Department of Environmental Protection. Good morning, Pam.
Good morning.
When I met you a couple of years ago, or even perhaps more recently, I was stuck with the fact that you moved from Seattle to New York City, kind of a bold move. And I'm sure it's not because of the laid-back culture of New York City. What inspired you to do that?
No, it wasn't the laid-back culture. It was probably more the opposite of that, to be honest. So I had a 30-year career in Seattle. I started in 15 years at the state regulatory agency doing Clean Water Act enforcement. And then I worked in the wastewater utility there, and I became the director of the King County Wastewater Treatment Division. I climbed to the, you know, kind of the top of that organization. And, you know, this was 2015 or so, and felt that, you know, I reached a plateau and I'm looking for what's the next thing to do, and actually started thinking about it. And then what happens is I'm sitting at my office one day and I get a call from a recruiter that said, hey, go apply for this job in New York City. And I said, okay, I'll do that. And somehow I made it through that process and got hired. So I think it was just more of a timing and a sense of adventure. I really feel like, you know, the saying, if you could make it here, you can make it anywhere in New York City. And I kind of think that's true, because I don't think, well, there isn't one as big in terms of wastewater utilities in the whole country. And the complexity and the history of it just is phenomenal. So the challenge and the excitement of it, there's no reason I could say no to it.
So you are now responsible for one of the most important cities in the world in terms of collection, treatment, and disposal. Sounds like a daunting task. How do you do that?
So I actually think about this in two different ways. So how do we do it? And then how do I do it? Our mission is to protect public health and enhance the environment through treating wastewater, managing stormwater, and really trying to generate resources out of wastewater. So to me, it's being mission, vision-driven, advocating, leading this very large, complex public utility, trying to find resources and identify risks and really keep us operating as best we can be. How do we do it? It is multiple layers of people. We have 1,800 people here just dealing with the wastewater treatment side. We have another 1,200 people who deal just with the smaller collection pipes in the streets. We treat 1.3 billion gallons every day if it's dry outside. If it rains, it's 3.6 billion or more. And it's all the wastewater that comes through every industry, household, facility. I look at new apartment buildings going up. I'm thinking those are more customers for us. So we have to manage the amount of stormwater that comes in peaks, either by storing, treating, diverting. That's the bulk of what we do. On the same time, my job is to ensure that we have the capital and operating funds to meet the existing needs. And on top of it, look at climate change resiliency, carbon sequestration, energy conservation, a whole set of what are today's new goals to make us sustainable throughout the future.
So this is an enormous task, just the size and complexity of this infrastructure that nobody sees over ground. Is there terms you can put around it, numbers you can put around it?
One of my goals in life is that what we do doesn't stay underground, because everybody needs it. I want everybody who uses a toilet to visit a wastewater resource recovery facility where that discharge goes to. Everybody should know what that means, because otherwise it is underground and you don't care or know about it. And all you know is if something bad happens. For the 99.99999% of the time that we're doing our jobs and there aren't the challenges that make it difficult, you don't know that we exist. So it is important for people to understand that. So our system, like I was talking about, is the largest in the country, 1 to 2 to 3 billion gallons in a day. I mean, I can't even visualize how big that is, right? Every neighborhood, every borough has a wastewater resource recovery facility. There's 14 in total, ranging from 50 million gallons a day to 700 million gallons a day in some cases. We've got in the city 7,500 miles of pipelines underground that convey waste through interceptors and big pumping stations to get it to these 14 facilities. We've got 96 pumping stations. We also have 4 combined sewer overflow treatment sites. So we're actually taking stormwater, primarily stormwater mixed with some wastewater, and treating it so that we can maintain a water quality in the receiving water. You asked me, what should a average person know about their wastewater? They should just go visit a facility. It's chemical, physical, biological systems that are, in a sense, they're mimicking nature to create clean water and fertilizer products the way nature intended, but speeding it up, you know, in terms of hours rather than what it takes in the natural environment to break down waste.
It's very interesting, Pam, because I do believe that it is an engineering marvel of the last 40, 50 years to be able to create a technology and set a process that would keep our public health and sanitation in check, at least for the developed countries, for sure. So it's less understood, but I think the advent of technology, social media, access to these facilities would make an average person very intelligent about this process. So coming back to this massive infrastructure you described, for sure, the way you described it, it's worth the trip from Seattle.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
But everybody talks about aging infrastructure. And given just the amount of assets you just described, I don't see no less challenge in New York City. Can you quantify this problem before we talk about solutions?
So it's a very interesting time right now in my business. It's always interesting, but it's particularly, we're at a node, I think, where the past, the present, and the future is what we have to manage every day. So we started wastewater facilities in New York City in 1897, the first one that was built around Coney Island where people would bathe, right? So somehow we figured out in the late 1800s, wastewater, human contact, bad thing, right? So we started to build plants. And then in the 1930s, there was a boom. We built a number of facilities throughout the city. Some of those structures are still in service. You know, they built things well back then. 1970s and 80s, we had more upgrades, mechanical, electrical. We added biological treatment systems at that time frame. So 80s and 70s, that's still 50 years ago. We're building these essential public facilities. Like I said, there's over $40 billion invested over time. And we've got to maintain that infrastructure. We've got to upgrade where it's necessary. We're constantly looking at the condition of our assets, trying to repair and replace them most cost-effectively. At the same time, meet the present operating conditions. We have very strict environmental compliance requirements put upon us by the state, which is there should be. And then we're got the future to deal with, which is all about climate change and resiliency. So we have a huge resiliency program to protect essential public facilities against the next Sandy storm or a hurricane or sea level rise, which is a reality, and temperature changes. We've got specific goals through the city on energy conservation and carbon sequestration. So this is new to us. I mean, it's new in a sense of we've got to focus on that more. We've always produced a green gas at our wastewater facilities, for example. And the green gas comes from our solids processing, which is a gas that can be used for power. It creates methane that can be used to power boilers or create electricity. We have to think about using that more. We have to be 100% use of our biogas. We also now are taking food waste to one of our wastewater facilities where we have excess digester capacity. So we're increasing the amount of biogas we're making, and we're taking food waste out of landfills, right? So that's the future that we're on the cusp of having to embrace. So that's the challenge. The real challenge is how do you financially maintain the past, perform in the present, at the same time invest in the future? So it's a very interesting overlay time for us. I feel super lucky to be in this place at this time to have to deal with that, because we're setting precedent for us to be successful in the future or potentially not be successful. So it's a lot. It's a lot to get your mind around.
In parallels of New York City being a financial hub, in many respects, you are a $40 billion asset manager.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Think about it that way, right?
That's right, right, right.
So it's amazing to manage a $40 billion asset. That's anywhere between 100 to, you know, 50, 30-year-old, and not only build the green infrastructure of the future. What's your roadmap for the 21st century infrastructure in New York City? And are you integrating specific, give me three examples of specific advanced technologies that you are building for the 21st century New York City infrastructure?
We are not wastewater treatment anymore. We're wastewater resource recovery facilities. This means green products. I was just in Amsterdam. There's an international water conference that happens every other year there. And some of the wastewater utilities there are pulling out phosphorus. They're making bioplastics. They're making plastic out of what comes into the wastewater. They're harvesting cellulose, which is a big component of what is in the wastewater, to make paper products, building materials, insulation. So we really are green industries, and we are resource recovery facilities that's taking what is a waste and making it into valuable products. And the more that we do that, the more that we can actually offset revenue. We can actually reduce the amount of waste that we have within our facilities and really be a major player for sustainability. And I think we are a cornerstone of sustainability in a local sense, because everybody, to be crass, everybody poops and everybody needs us and we're everywhere.
It's very interesting, Pam, because it's total redefinition of what a wastewater industry leader or the wastewater industry as a whole or sector as a whole it is. It isn't just about treating wastewater. It's about green energy production, right? It's reuse and sustainability. So with that, what should be the traits of the leader of the future in this space? And in fact, that redefinition can attract a whole new batch of leaders that this industry has never attracted in the past.
So wastewater resource recovery, leaders of the future. Sometimes people think we could design our way around this, like we'll find a technology that saves the world. I think we can go a long way of instituting what we know already a lot smarter. It requires a creative thinking and a willingness to take risks and try things that maybe haven't been done before in a particular context. So I think the leader of the future needs to have that awareness. I also think in my industry, to really shift to being a resource recovery minded individual rather than wastewater treatment. We do that really well. The water quality around New York City is the cleanest it's been in 100 years. And we know that for sure because we've been sampling it that long. The fisheries have come back. We actually have whale tour boats now. You can hire somebody to take you on a boat and go visit the whales, just like Alaska. Only without the glaciers. And I think sometimes people forget that when I go talk to some of the advocates for sustainability that, well, why aren't you investing more in solar or some other, you know, wind energy? You know, my base infrastructure is that sustainability. My production of biogas is what we're doing here. And that biogas is super valuable. So we are investing on a diverse portfolio of sustainability programs like solar. Like we have solar installation at some of our facilities. We've got a 1.2 megawatt installation at one of our plants. And the other thing, and I touched on this earlier, is being a major player in sustainability. For example, I mentioned food waste going to a digester, right? So if we can expand that, New York City creates 4,000 tons a day of food waste. Half of that's residential, 2,000, half of that's commercial, industrial. Right now, we're taking 130 tons a day into our Newtown Creek Wastewater Resource Recovery Facility directly to the digesters, increasing our biogas production by 10%. If we dedicated our investments to increasing our capacity for solids processing at all of our plants, we'd be able to take 100% of the food waste in New York City. Now, that's not something that's going to happen overnight because, you know, there's a long-term investment and construction that would have to happen, but we're trying to gear that way. And if you could take 100% of the food waste in New York City, that means there's no trucks driving far away to go to a landfill or even to a composting facility. So you're saving on that. You're creating a green gas that can be used locally. It could be used for transportation fuel. It could be used to make electricity. In this case, in Newtown Creek, we're scrubbing the gas and putting it back in the pipeline. So think about the full closed economy, the circular economy there. You cook your dinner, you put your food waste in your bin, you use your toilet. The food waste goes to a processor, makes a little slurry. Both of those things go to the wastewater plant. Both of those things create clean water, other valuable products, and biogas, which goes back to your house, which then you cook your dinner with. It's a local circular economy that I would like everybody to be excited about and support these concepts so that we can really take the next step in making those sort of things happen.
It's fascinating, Pam. So you just consume today 130 tons out of 4,000 tons for food waste. What's your roadmap in the next 10 years?
We can't just dive into, like, the food waste is a perfect example. So food is different than the human waste that we get, that we take the solids and eventually put them in digesters. So we've had to step into that slowly because there's a biological system that works anaerobically in a digester, just like your stomach. And if we're adding a different feed to that digester, how would it change? So we had a demonstration project for the last couple of years to see, is it going to modify that bacteria community in the digester detrimentally? And so we've stepped into that. So we have our roadmap from the food waste side, and on the biogas side is to get to 250 tons a day, that one facility. We could take 500 tons a day total. So over the next 2 years, I want to take 500 tons a day at Newtown Creek, which is 25% of the commercial food waste, right? That's a specific arm of our roadmap. The other big component we have is in a wastewater system is you create a biosolids product, which is a very valuable fertilizer. And when I came from the Seattle area, we had 100% of that went to beneficial use. It was used as a fertilizer on farms and forests. In New York City, we used to do that, but in the mid-2000s, it got really cheap to landfill. It cut the cost in half of what the program cost was. So right now, most of our biosolids go to landfill. It is a valuable product that's being essentially thrown away. My roadmap on that side is to get our biosolids program back in the game because it is a valuable product for carbon sequestration. In fact, in Seattle area and King County, I had 5 wastewater treatment plants, smaller scale, of course, totally. But with the carbon sequestration value of the biosolids and our green gas production, we ran the utility at carbon neutral. It was carbon neutral. In fact, it became a carbon sink over time. So that's, again, an example of how we are central to sustainability in that sense. So that's another big component of trying to get back in the game of beneficial reuse of biosolids. That in itself is a complicated premise because, you know, people have this like ick factor for sewage. I got to tell you that biosolids are regulated far more than a fertilizer product you would buy at Home Depot. In fact, in my previous job, we tested our biosolids and we did same testing at steer manure at Home Depot, and there was way more antibiotics and chemicals in the steer manure product than there was in the biosolids product. So, you know, there's multiple prongs of all these different approaches. And at the same time, I just want to go back to the aging infrastructure piece in that we really need to, what we call it, a state of good repair. Like if our facilities were at a state of good repair, that means we're maintaining, replacing, operating optimally everywhere, then that actually frees up funding for these other programs. So to get us to this operating state of good repair to support everything that's going on top of it, that to me is the core. And when you think about a future leader, is you can't always be about the future. You have to maintain the base to be able to add upon it. It's like building a house without a foundation. You don't want to do that.
Right. So we call this ambidextrous leadership.
That's a good term.
So on one side, you have to work your machine of today to ensure everything is running well. On the other hand, you're strategizing for the future, which is kind of what you're doing from what I hear. Pam, we talked a lot about extracting energy, gas energy, creating bioproducts that go as fertilizers, extracting phosphorus, creating paper products. I mean, it's amazing all the stuff coming out of a wastewater process. One concept we haven't yet touched, perhaps a difficult concept, is water, reuse of the water that's coming out of the plant. These are reuse of byproducts of the process. What is your view on reuse water?
So recycled water is what it is. There is X amount of water in the world, and You use it in one place. It doesn't disappear. It goes somewhere else. So recycling water, I think you asked me previously, do you believe in it? And I'm like, well, I believe in air. So yeah, I mean, it's happening anywhere. And when I do tours sometimes with young people at the treatment plants and I talk about the water cycle, I say to them, you know, the water molecules on this earth have been here forever. And dinosaur pee, which has water in it, is still here, right? And, you know, it's kind of a way for them to understand that water is water. Now, yes, if it comes to us mixed with waste, it's wastewater. And we already create a valuable product. The biggest product we make right now is clean water. And I described the huge improvement in the regional water quality because of that. What we've been putting out of our treatment plants is cleaner than the existing water in the surrounding area. So we've been a big player in that recovery, right?
So I want to switch the topics a little bit. Outside of your day job, you have a personal mission. It's called Living Earth Institute. Tell us what it is and why.
Yeah, I gave you my quick sort of bio earlier, but I went to college, got an engineering degree. I grew up in the Chicago area. I never left the country before in my entire life. I'd been in an airplane like twice before that. After graduating, I got in a plane and went to Kathmandu, Nepal, because I joined the Peace Corps. And there, and it's amazing as an older person to think of that younger person doing that, because it's, I guess it's indicative of my personality and being willing to go to New York City, because that's nothing compared to jumping on a plane and going to Kathmandu. So I built water systems in these small communities. I lived in rural Nepal. I built gravity-fed water systems. I designed it. It was a UNICEF project that I worked on, and it was very well supported. And I had equipment and warehouses and a staff and porters and all that. And it was an amazing education in terms of the value of what I do today. So I think it's the basis that inspires me, actually, around this whole thing. And that's one of the reasons why it's important for me that people understand the value of the work we do, because without it, it is literally a life and death construct. So I did that.
A leader of one of the largest wastewater systems in the world, he is going to a tiny village in Kathmandu or Nepal and working on water wastewater systems. That is a phenomenal bookends of systems in our world.
Yeah.
I mean, the story, I like that story. And I want to know why.
Well, I think, I mean, I'm on the extreme ends of the wastewater world in a sense, because after the Peace Corps, eventually I decided to start a nonprofit called the Living Earth Institute. This was in 1999. And with that, I continued to build water and sanitation systems in rural Nepal. And it really became more focused on the sanitation and toilet side, because you can't have clean water without sanitation, which is obvious. So that's why, the why. I mean, what happened in the late 90s is I found myself in a place where I suddenly knew people in Nepal. It's all driven by Nepali people, local people. Since the beginning of it, we've done a few projects in other countries, but it's mostly been in Nepal. I knew people who can do this. They just needed support financially. And we're talking $50,000 a year, which in the context of what I spend in New York City, that is nothing. If I could raise that money, there could be a huge change at these villages where we're working. So it's like, I couldn't not do that. I just had to figure out how to set up a nonprofit and all that, which, you know, it's not that complicated.
So $40 billion asset manager is working on $50,000 sanitation system in Nepal. Very interesting to me. So with this international experience, here's my question. Can U.S. export, and export can be both financially motivated and non-financially motivated. It could be both. Anything to the rest of the world in terms of water and clean water?
That's kind of back to the technology question. And I said earlier, lack of water and wastewater treatment is less of a technology problem and more of a social, political, community problem. And one of the things I like to reflect on in my Nepal experience is I talked about hiring social workers and community organizers to do the work. And when we did that, the question that we were trying to crack is, what does it take for these small, super valuable, life-changing systems to be sustainable? And what the social worker type organizer community realized is they wanted to have some kind of financial support around it so that the community develops along with the wastewater projects as well, or the toilets and the water supply. So they created women's income generation training programs, which really took off. And there's a couple of videos on my website, which I still find inspiring to watch because we actually go and interview some women about the changes before and after. They created a micro lending program. So women started businesses that enabled them to increase their family's income, to pay into the maintenance fund that's used for the water system. And that's a holistic approach to solving the problem. So when you think about exporting U.S. technology or know-how, I would like to change it back into how do you inform and support and export that organizational method, that organizational concept that makes anything that you do on technology, even if it's simple technology, sustainable.
One of my last questions to you, give us one deep insight about wastewater that everyone should know that you would say, wow, I didn't know this.
You, everybody, are part of the success to keep the wastewater systems that we have running. You have a central role in supporting it, understanding its role for sustainability and combating climate change, for creating the green energy that we create. And as part of your responsibility in that success, only flush four things. Poop, pee, puke, toilet paper. Four P's, nothing else, no flushable wipes. If it says flushable on the box, it ain't flushable. This is creating havoc in your wastewater systems. It's creating millions and millions of dollars being spent on our end, your money, public, on something that doesn't need to be spent on. So put it in the trash can and manage it that way, because it comes to us, it is a nasty mess that we spend millions and millions, over $20 million a year, just trying to unplug and manage that unnecessary waste stream. So that is my final insight, my lecture, my direction to everybody is the four P's is all we want to see.
All right. So Pam, it's been a fascinating conversation, a $40 billion asset manager, Nepal experience, moving from Seattle to New York, working on food to waste energy on the largest system in the country, and talking about four P's. It is just a fascinating, fascinating story. And I think we're going to, a lot of us have learned so much from you. Thank you, Pam.
Well, thank you very much. I fairly appreciate the platform and I appreciate the interest and the way that you set this up to help spread the word.
Thanks, Pam.
Thank you.
Join host and AquaSight founder and CEO Mahesh Lunani again next month for another episode of 21st Century Water. Subscribe for free in Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, or Stitcher. Produced by Jag and Detroit Podcasts.